Hello, and welcome to episode 15 of Awin Talks, the affiliate marketing podcast. This month, I'm joined by both Kevin Edwards and Craig Foster, I'm delighted to say, is back from the United States of America. How was it, Craig?
Really good, thanks. Yeah, excellent.
What did you get up to?
What a loads.
I had a list for this podcast.
Yeah, yes, definitely too much for this podcast. Yeah, I ticked off a lot of things that I wanted to do on the list of the US, including I went to a rodeo.
Was this not the second time that you went to a rodeo?
No. It's definitely not my first rodeo, though. That's the only reason I went, just so I can say that now as well. I got invited to a wedding when I was out there, which is amazing.
Not yours?
No, held a gun in my own home, very US.
Very US.
Yeah, that's very US. Not mine. It wasn't my gun. I didn't buy a gun or anything like that.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I did a lot. Yeah, it was really good. Really good fun.
Good. Well, it's good to have you back. On today's episode, you'll be speaking to Ed Chaput, Awin's product marketing manager, a little bit later to talk about some of the product updates that have been happening over the last few months.
Yeah. Yeah, so Ed's coming on to talk about some of the more exciting kind of products that we're releasing, that we're just releasing now or in a couple of months as well.
And I will also be talking to James Maley, who is the business development director over at Revlifter, one of our publisher technology partners. And I'll be talking to him about the upcoming peak period around Black Friday and Singles Day, and asking him about the personalization technology that they provide for advertisers relating to discounting tactics and how that's being implemented right now. Before that, though, we wanted to touch off a few updates relating to the industry. The first of these being the recent IPMA Awards. This was the International Performance Marketing Awards that occurred a few weeks back, just before PI Live, the annual industry conference. And Awin ended up winning 4 awards in total, including those for Carrefour for the Latin American Best Performance Marketing Campaign. HP also won for Best Content Marketing Campaign. We had a win within the Best Technology and Telecoms campaign with SmarterClick and Carphone Warehouse. And then finally, we also got the award for Best Performance Marketing Campaign Western Europe for the work undertaken by VouchCloud and Curry's PC World on the Red Dead Redemptions game. So that was a great night for the network there. And the following morning, we kicked off with PI Live, with several sessions taking place as part of that, including my own manifesto talk, which kicked off at 9:30 in the morning. And unfortunately, because there were some queuing issues outside the conference venue itself, it wasn't quite as full as we'd hoped. However, we have subsequently recorded that presentation just this week, and that has now been released and has been published on the Market Insights website. So you can go and check that out for yourself right now. The manifesto itself was an opportunity to talk about a framework for success in affiliate marketing in the future, looking towards 2020 and beyond. Next year is actually Awin's 20th anniversary as a company. So we saw it as an opportunity to really take a retrospective look at how the company has evolved over the last couple of decades alongside the wider industry itself. And we wanted to suggest what we've learned over that time and how that's informed our status as a big full service network over the last few years. And that manifesto really goes into some detail around some of the basic principles that we think need to improve in order for the wider industry to further develop and grow. Now, Kev, I know that you were there over the course of the 2 days of the conference, and you had your own session on the second day. What was that to do with?
So the idea for the session came about in the summer. Sean from Equator and I, who are members of the advisory board for PI Live for choosing the sessions, came up with the idea of some sort of rapid fire case studies, because we know that people love to hear how kind of brands are tackling affiliate marketing. And we decided that it was also a great opportunity to hopefully sort of encourage some new speakers to come and present, speakers who hadn't presented for the any event before. And so we got we reached out to the wider community, and 5 people put themselves forward, and they had 5-minute slot each, and they all presented on campaigns that either their companies had been running or campaigns that they had worked on. So it was a great opportunity for new speakers to come in, take to the stage and present their kind of success stories.
Yeah, I thought that was a great example. And it was something that I cited in the manifesto talk itself, actually, of industry collaboration. So you have different individuals coming from very different companies and businesses right across the industry, all collaborating and contributing to that particular session to talk about, you know, great demonstrations of affiliate marketing in practice. And another great example of that came just a week later when I was helping to coordinate and participate in an affiliate session at the IAB's Nonference event, which is an annual industry conference that they hold, which is designed to provide an interactive, dynamic and environment where audiences can very much participate in presentations that are occurring, from to hear from figures from right across the digital spectrum. So everything from search to social to affiliates to display. All of these different businesses are presenting sessions in a quite unorthodox and quite left field fashion. So I worked with a host of figures from across the affiliate industry to coordinate that affiliate session. And we came up with this concept of using Blind Date, the TV show from the, what, mid-90s, I think that was around. Cilla Black was obviously
there. Yeah, they've got like an updated version now, I think, as well. But yeah, it's earlier than the 90s.
So you remember the premise behind Blind Date, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you've got...
A massive fan.
Yeah, no doubt. And
hope to be on it one day.
We did use that kind of format of having three candidates that could be questioned around their suitability for an individual advertiser's objectives for an advertising campaign. So those three candidates were represented by three publisher types. So you had one that was representing an incentive site, one representing a mass media publishing house, and one representing an influencer. And so audience participants were then invited to ask them about how those individual publisher types could help deliver on a specific advertiser objective that we had given them. And it all led to a fairly entertaining innuendo-filled session, which I'm sure Cilla herself would have been proud of.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was your delivery like? Was it as good as our Cilla's?
I mean, I wasn't playing Cilla Black herself, actually. Thankfully, somebody from...
Someone professional
turned up and did it. Yeah, exactly. It was Dan Albra from Optimize stepped into the breach there wearing a Cilla mask, which went down very well. So... but talking of more collaborations within the industry, the newly formed publisher board is something that's also been announced quite recently. Do you know more about that, Craig?
Yeah. So this is something that actually I think, you know, has been a long time coming. And you know, it's been launched recently. It's kind of a place where, you know, any publisher can come and join up. And what it aims to do, I suppose, is kind of give a collective voice for publishers. For a long time, publishers have spoken with each other and they've had the same kind of grievances within the channel. And, you know, from a network, we've seen this for a long time. But effectively, what you've always had is these voices in silo and not really getting anywhere with it. And it will be interesting to see if that kind of collectivism can improve standards. Because effectively, if you are good, like we know that collectivism works in all areas of the economy. So you can actually, with a collective voice, do something. It will be pretty good. We'll see. I mean, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, we've seen them just publish their advertiser best practice guidelines, haven't they? So like you say, it'll be interesting to see what the response is from advertisers, how the wider industry reacts to that. I'm looking forward to see some of the debates that kick off the back of the initiatives they're undertaking.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like we've got the IAB, obviously, and we've had advertiser standards kind of written there. We've never had as much publisher involvement within the IAB. And I think that perhaps this is a way for them to put something forward. And you know, maybe it's a chance for the IAB to look at this and kind of amend their own standards to this. So it gives it a bit more weight as well.
I'm certainly keen to make sure that they align, because we're currently... A few of us are currently working with the IB to rework the existing advertiser and publisher standards charters that were first created, 9-10 years ago, and then updated. Yeah. And those, I think, have really fallen by the wayside. I think there's a very little awareness of them. But actually, whilst they don't go into the level of detail that this document does, I think that they cover a number of the same points, and so that it's really important that we align those two pieces of work rather than they kind of exist separately, because otherwise, you know, that then becomes quite confusing. As you say, publishers have never really. We've only ever had a handful of publishers that have been members of the IAB. There's always been the sticking point that it's fairly expensive to become a member of the IAB. So we have tried to reach out to the broader publisher community in the past, but that doesn't really align itself very well with the IAB pricing model. So I think we have some ideas, and I think, you know, the main thing for us is to kind of keep communicating with this publisher board, to make sure that those pieces of work are aligned.
Do you think that this the formation of this board now, as opposed to maybe years previously before, where it's been talked about a lot but it's never quite kind of gotten over the gain line, as it were, and do you think that's as a consequence of publisher interest being taken more seriously, maybe a kind of shift in dynamic in power, actually, maybe towards publishers, whereas historically it could be argued that more of that power lay with advertisers and brands within the affiliate channel.
I would say that it potentially is as simple as a handful of people kind of pushing this initiative on, because that's always been the way, even within any of the IAB work. You know, people are happy to support stuff, but they won't necessarily have the time or the inclination to get involved. And I think, you know, this has very much been driven by a handful of individuals. And I don't think anyone would find any of the points in it controversial or unreasonable.
It's stuff that's not talked about necessarily, though. I was looking at it before, and, you know, there are some things in here that are covered that perhaps advertisers aren't even aware of that would be helpful for publishers. Things like, you know, the existing customers should be 6 months. Should be considered as an existing customer up until 6 months or something like that. Or, you know, you must give 30 days notice to, you know, reduce commissions. So I think, yes, you're right. Like, there are, you know, I do think it's a case of, we'll see how it pans out. One thing, the reservations I have is, you know, it's always about enforcing. And the problem we've got, especially in the markets like the UK, is when you've got an advertiser who is committing bad, is kind of breaking these terms, are publishers going to stop promoting that advertiser? And
which
that is the question.
They've never done.
And so the enforcement really comes from this, is that those members of this board will have to at some point decide whether or not they would take a commercial hit to enforce these rules. And that's the big question. Because if they don't, then it won't work.
I don't think you'll ever get to the stage where you've got a perfect world where everybody is adhering to all of these standards. But as you say, I think there's an awareness issue. And I think that's partly to do with churn within the industry, you know, new people coming in all the time, people leaving, people switching, changing jobs. So I think that in terms of raising awareness, especially for new people coming in, maybe new campaigns launching, if you have these standards, if you're aware of them and you adhere to them from the go, then, you know, that has to be seen as a positive thing. So it's not just about necessarily what the enforcement is, it's about the awareness of those topics as well. But definitely, I think that we've never really seen affiliates voting with their
ads.
Links before
affiliate voting with links. Yeah,
and I guess, I mean, your mention of enforcement is quite a nice segue into the final topic that I just wanted to touch on, because if we're talking about these kinds of things being enforced by a collective, then actually by contrast, we can see that when regulators step in and enforce rules and guidelines, then there's an immediate kind of impact there. And I mentioned that just off the back of the ASA, the Advertising Standards Authority in the UK, who have ruled against the retail brand Matalan, relating to an affiliate of theirs called The Londoner, who had published a piece of content which contained a commercial link to Matalan without disclosing that it was an ad. Now, this has provoked, obviously, some debate within the industry, because this wasn't a paid-for placement that Matalan had arranged. This was a piece of content that The Londoner had created themselves and then put an affiliate link through from a mention, I think it was of a dress that was being sold on Matalan into that piece of content. What's your take on the ruling and the reaction from the industry?
Well, having read the ruling, I think reading between the lines, it sounds as if it was a pretty standard affiliate relationship in that it's an affiliate that signed up to a program, had promoted some content. You'd obviously taken links from an interface and put those links behind it. So it would be what we would consider to be a normal affiliate relationship. They had said that they had put disclosures and disclaimers, which, you know, has always been something that has been lacking, I think, and continues to lack in the industry. I don't think this is anything that really differs from ASA advice. There's been some discussion about whether this is sort of a game changer. I think it's only really a game changer in that it's showing that the ASA is fully aware of affiliate marketing. And that awareness has definitely grown, I would say, in the last 3 or 4 years. We met the ASA a few years ago, actually, and discussed with them because they wanted to know more about affiliate marketing. And subsequent to that, they have released affiliate guidance. I think that I've got the ruling in front of me here, and it says that the ASA concluded that in the absence of a clear and prominent identifier besides those links, such as hashtag ad, the links on the blog post did not make clear their commercial intent and breached the code. So it doesn't necessarily say that people have to use hashtag ad. It says a clear and prominent identifier, and the site that obviously springs to mind is Money Saving Expert in the way that they do that. That they put an asterisk against any link that they potentially earn commission off the back of. And that for me, whilst they haven't explicitly stated that, you know, because they've never really, I would imagine, looked at Money Saving Expert as a site and understood how they list that, I would imagine that for them would be considered to be a clear and prominent identifier. So with the ASA, I think that they recognize that they understand industries well, but they with regulation, you know, there's always this sort of gray area or the flexibility for industries to develop their own solutions. And I think that any regulator is always keen for industries to develop their own solutions. And I think that is definitely something that we as a major affiliate network need to work more collaboratively with other companies in the space, like we have done in the past around voucher coding and software, downloadable software. That is definitely something I think that we should be looking to initiate and work collaboratively, potentially with the ASA, to actually guide publishers, because otherwise we could end up with a really fragmented way of publishers coming up with their own solutions.
I think it's particularly interesting, this ruling, in the wake of our attendance at the Association of Online Publishers event, which was a couple of weeks back. Another trade body that represents and advocates for some of the bigger publications, online publications and mass media publishing houses here in the UK. And one of the constant threads throughout that affiliate focused session, so it was an entire kind of session that was focused on affiliate marketing, which was really interesting in itself, that there was a real serious focus upon the channel as a means of generating revenue for them. But one of the constant threads that cropped up at that session was relating to the lack or the vacuum of a kind of vacuum of guidance that's come from the affiliate industry in terms of disclosure and how they should approach disclosing to their users. And I mean, we're talking about sites that have millions and millions of users every month visiting their websites and engaging with their content. And there was a real anxiety on their part around not having guidance and not having any real kind of templated approach to how you disclose commercial links and affiliate links. And I think that speaks volumes, particularly in the wake of this ruling from the ASA, because it's exactly the kind of thing that they were anxious about happening, I guess, to them. So
it's been a long time coming, I think.
Yeah, we spoke about this years ago, and I think that we were kind of under the assumption that the ASA didn't really, weren't going to focus on affiliates. They were going to focus in other areas first, which is what they did, but they were always going to come to the point where they are going to look at affiliate websites. That was always going to eventually happen.
I think that coming back to my earlier point, this is definitely something that is front of mind for a lot of brands now. And as soon as it becomes sort of headline news, then brands obviously become nervous and they will look to networks, probably in the first instance that they work with, to have solutions in place. So it's beholden on us, I think, to take responsibility for doing this and helping whilst we're not actually responsible, you know, ASA guidance wouldn't, we wouldn't be held liable for it. It would be the advertiser and the publisher. We definitely, I think, have a role to play in helping to shape what that looks like.
And now joining us on the podcast, we have James Maley, Head of Business Development at RevLifter. And I wanted to talk to James a little bit about RevLifter's proposition, about how that fits into the peak golden quarter that we're just about to hit right now. But first, before getting into RevLifter and its particular kind of attraction for advertisers, I wanted to ask a little bit about your own background, James, and just tell us a little bit about your experience in digital and obviously within the wider affiliate channel.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. I guess I've been around in digital about 12 years. I actually started off at an affiliate network back in the day in client services, and actually ended up heading that team up before moving client side, heading up the affiliate channel, programmatic and Meta. And then moving on to a technology partner, and then again working back at a network within the sales team. So I now find myself at RevLifter heading up the sales team. So I guess you could say I've kind of done the full circle.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of different perspectives, I guess, that you've had on the channel, which I guess has helped maybe inform your opinions on where the industry is right now and kind of how it's evolved over the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, I think the industry's come an awful long way. I mean, you know, when I first started, the landscape looked very, very different. But, you know, there are still some things that have stayed the same. I mean, we still see lots of, you know, discount traffic and cashback traffic driving the majority of programs. One thing that has changed dramatically for me has just been the amount of data we can now process and actually use to actually facilitate kind of where programs are heading. So, you know, we've come a long way.
Yeah, and I think that segues quite nicely into where you are right now with RevLifter as well, doesn't it? So for those of the audience that are listening that aren't familiar with what you guys do, could you give us a little kind of top line summary?
Yeah, sure. So RevLifter is a personalization platform. We're really all about delivering the right deal to the right customer at the right time. And what that really means is, and when I say deal especially, it doesn't necessarily mean a discount code actually. It's really flipping something like personalization on its head. So when we talk about deal and personalization, we actually think about what's good for the advertiser before we even consider the consumer, because you can't really market to your consumers any types of deals until you know what it is you're trying to achieve. So we're really all about giving, you know, making sure the advertiser is able to market their products in a way that's good for their margin, for their stock, also, you know, able to actually, you know, facilitate the consumer discounts in the right way, the messaging, the semantics, you know, things like high street and luxury fashion, for example, are two very different verticals, and we need to make sure that we're meeting the advertiser needs at the same time. So at RevLifter, we're really all about making sure that, you know, we help advertisers deliver those deals to those consumers in a format that's going to be beneficial to their business and the consumer.
Sure. So, I mean, discounting tactics are obviously never more important than they are right now. Black Friday's legacy kind of over the last kind of 10, 15 years has really kind of brought that to the fore, I think. I wonder what your opinion on how events like Black Friday and Singles Day as well from China have really shaped consumer behavior.
So, I mean, these types of events like Black Friday and Singles Day in China are really teaching consumers the wrong behavior. I think, you know, we're waiting around for discounts, and actually a lot of the time these discounts don't take into consideration the gross margin on products. It also actually affects returns rate quite considerably. So last year, if you look at Black Friday, for example, the average shopper spent about £313, but actually 50% of those goods were returned. And that actually cost the UK economy about £7 billion. Now, the logistical cost of actually, you know, returning those gifts actually cost businesses quite a significant amount of money. And also, you know, with this herd mentality, it also creates a material gluttony. I think as advertisers and you know, within our industry, we have almost a responsibility to, you know, be personalizing these deals better to consumers, and also to make them more considered around their purchases, because ultimately, you know, these goods that are being returned either can't be resold on, so it's wasted product, or they have to be discounted even further because they're returned goods. So it's just not good for the economy overall, I think.
I think there's almost, there's another element as well, isn't there, in that same dilemma and that same debate, which is arguably around kind of the environmental cost as well. So, I mean, if you're managing to target consumers with relevant deals and they're buying the right products that they want and they need and that they're going to keep, then obviously that has an efficiency as far as the environment's concerned and the sustainability of those costs as well.
Yeah, I think you just used a key word there, sustainability. And I think, you know, recent generations, especially coming in who have purchasing power, really do care about that. If you look at, you know, the recent speech by Greta Thunberg in the UN, and you've also got brands like Toms gifting shoes to children in Africa, and also those other brands that are, you know, making products out of waste plastic, for example. People do actually care about these things, and I think it's this is where personalization really comes into its own, because we then start to think about pairing the right products with the right consumers, and we're actually, you know, brand loyalty is also part of that as well. You're almost creating a new type of economy.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, as well as this aspect of brand loyalty, because I did a talk only a couple of months ago, I think now, which talked about this dilemma of brand loyalty that has really evolved and radically been reshaped, I think, by the introduction of the internet, the amount of access and the amount of different options that it gives consumers in terms of different competing brands. And it's largely empowered them, I think, in being able to make more considered choices around the different retailers that they can buy from.
Yeah.
And that has arguably led to this new era of consumer disloyalty. That's something that's been kind of a quote that's been referenced and cited by various research firms at the moment in terms of consumer behavior and how that's evolved. And there's a real pivotal role for affiliates to play now in that particular era by being able to impart confidence for consumers in buying from new brands, potentially in being able to give them the kind of information that they then need to make an informed decision about where they want to spend their money.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, you know, the key thing really around the brands that are succeeding, especially the brands that are coming into their own and that are pretty much purely digital, are the fact that they're getting personalization pretty much spot on. We see personalization often in our industry as one dimensional, but the fact is there are multiple layers and multiple pillars. So to give you some examples, you know, we're now considering, especially at Revlifter, things like contextuality. So where have they come from? What devices are they purchasing on? And to give you a practical real world example, if you're looking at flights on your phone, you're probably very unlikely to purchase that flight because you're still in the dream phase. But if you're looking at accessories or a light bulb on your phone, you're very likely or have a high propensity to purchase things like, you know, intent as well, or garnering data. I've said this several times in lots of my talks recently, but brands like Clinique and Thread, for example, are really good at garnering data from their consumers very willingly before they even have a moment to purchase. And then of course we also have attributed data, and that's things like, you know, like date of birth or gender or whatever it might be. That still plays an important role, and the companies that are using that information are the companies that are succeeding, really, and I really believe that. And the companies that are, you know, struggling to convert to online, like, for example, with Thomas Cook recently, and with companies, with other high street retailers that can't decouple their offline businesses, you know, they're the ones that are struggling and that aren't personalizing correctly to their customers.
I mean, it's particularly interesting, I think, looking at how the importance that Amazon has taken on for consumers, particularly in that conversion phase of, you know, a lot of searching is now operating within Amazon's platform itself rather than outside of it in the wider kind of web environment, as it were. And by being able to personalize the deals and the products that they're offering to their users, they've obviously made a hugely successful strategy out of keeping them retained within that Amazon platform.
Yeah, I was actually waiting for you to bring up Amazon, to be honest with you. And do you know what it is? It is a problem for advertisers, and the problem is that they can't wean themselves off the Amazon drug, basically, because they rely on so many sales from them. And, you know, Amazon is a search engine in its own right, really. And do you know what? Their personalization at Amazon, I don't think, is actually all that good, to be honest with you.
To give you
real world examples, for example, I gave a talk at the IAB recently about where personalization's gone wrong, and, you know, there's been things like backpacks paired with kitchen knives, for example, you know, on the platform, and that's where you kind of get personalization wrong. I mean, that's an extreme example, but the reality is it uses lots of demographic data and lookalike type targeting rather than one-to-one marketing. And even if it's looking at your previous purchases, it doesn't take into considerations like your purchase habits will change around, say, Christmas time, for example, as opposed to when you're purchasing something in the summer. So yeah, Amazon is a challenge in our industry. And I think you're going to find advertisers asking for partners that have the ability to personalize and garner traffic back direct to their site in the right way, because ultimately they want consumers to buy from their site directly.
So if you think that Amazon perhaps are not doing it as effectively as they could, what kind of examples have you got from Revlifts are being used by retailers at the moment that kind of demonstrate, I guess, good practice?
Yeah, great. Okay, so we talked a bit about high returns rate over Black Friday, for example. One tactic that we deploy is to help reduce returns in a smart way. And the way that we do that is through dynamic gift cards, for example. So as a consumer reaches the basket, we may want them to add another 20, 30 pounds or whatever it might be. And then at that point, rather than using a voucher code, we'll say to the consumer, you know, here's a gift card for 25 pounds if you add these items to your basket. But the gift card won't be released until the returns policy has come to an end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ultimately the consumer is more considered about what they're going to buy. You've also then got a gift card being released after the returns policy, so reducing that. And it also opens a second basket too. So brands like high or fast fashion, for example, that struggle with return or repeat business because somebody's always on sale, actually then has the ability to bring that customer back to site because they've ultimately got a gift card. And the last thing I'll say is as well, if you're really smart with your gift card strategy as well around personalization, you'll put it just under your average order value. So they're still going to be spending money and stretching the basket.
Yeah, I think that's an important point as well, because obviously a lot of the antipathy that's come from retailers around Black Friday, I think, in the last few years is largely down to the fact that they feel that they're being compelled to have to do these steep discounts, which are cutting into their own bottom line. And gift carding and that kind of value add strategy is really helping to extend basket values.
Yeah, massively. I think so. And I think, you know, when we think about the deals channel or the voucher channel or whatever you want to call it, you know, we often just think about discount codes, but actually being smart and knowing when not to offer a discount, pairing products together, for example, fast and slow moving products, and then also using, you know, gift card mechanisms as well. And actually, you don't have to necessarily use your own brand gift cards, although it is preferable. You have partners like Revlifter, for example, that, you know, can use affinity brand gift cards, for example. So if you are booking, I don't know, travel, for example, offering Costa Coffee gift cards or something like that, making sure that you're giving a consumer something that they can use, you know, around what they're purchasing.
Yeah. So obviously, Black Friday is just around the corner. We've just had Singles Day. What do you think the future of these kinds of global retail events is likely to be?
I think what we'll find is that advertisers are going to become a lot more cautious. I mean, we're in considerably, we have a lot more uncertainty in the markets, things like Brexit, for example. Also, you know, advertisers' margins are being considerably stretched as well, as they're just trying to beat year-on-year sales, and that's all that seems to be the focus. The reality is that partners that are helping advertisers to personalize deals and goods to consumers based on their own objectives and what's important to them is going to be the future of affiliate marketing and the future of most paid channels. I think also, you know, lots of stores are or retailers are shutting their physical stores, so uncoupling from bricks and mortar is going to be key, and those advertisers that don't do that effectively are really going to struggle. So I think it's really important that channels like the affiliate channel, for example, are here to support, you know, strong ROI, strong incremental growth. People are much more savvy, they're shopping online, you know, so I think for us it's going to be all about making sure that, you know, we're releasing, you know, deals to the consumers at the right time.
Yeah, and that's interesting as well. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what Revlifter's plans might be for the future of the business and where you're taking not just personalization, but other kind of aspects to what you offer in your proposition.
Yeah, look, I mean, the reality is, you know, we are a personalization platform. We're a marketing technology. You know, we're going to be multi-channel. I mean, it's quite clear that we're going to be, you know, moving, you know, into email, probably within app, display, offline. You know, wherever the consumer touches the advertiser in any way, you know, we're going to be there to help that advertiser personalize their deals to consumers in real time. And you know, whether that be through the affiliate channel or through various other channels, ultimately, it's all about making sure we add incremental value at every touch point for that advertiser.
Great. Well, thanks for dropping in today to tell us a little bit more about Revlifter and giving us your opinions on the peak season that's coming ahead. Best of luck for it.
Thank you.
And yeah, we'll speak again soon.
Great. Thanks for your time.
So now we're joined by twice winner of the coveted Thomas More Annual Invitational Pool Tournament, an avid traveller, speaks four languages, two of them not based on fiction, an avid supporter and frequent contributor of catoftheday.com, even when he's told to stop, a great home cook, barbecue speciality, and a man who owns a sous vide. But more importantly, it's Awin's product marketing manager, Ed Chaput.
Thank you very much, Craig, for a truly wonderful introduction there. Absolutely fantastic. Yes, pleasure to be here. Second time on the podcast. So,
yeah, we said third time you get a match ball, so your hat trick. So we'll bring one of those in the next time you're
hopefully
on.
Next year.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so obviously we're going to be talking about some of the product releases that Awin have brought out or are bringing out. I was going to start off really, obviously, one of the things we've released recently is something that's quite popular at the moment amongst all kind of companies is the two-step authentication. Could you tell us a little bit more about that to start with?
Of course, yeah. Now, obviously, this has gone out actually on the day of recording, so spoilers alerts, it's not live, this podcast. But it is, yeah, it's something we've added on. It's an optional extra, and it's as simple as it is. It's just designed to secure your account a little bit more. Add that extra layer of security, given the information that both advertisers and publishers have in their account. You know, I think being as secure as possible in this day and age is the wisest thing.
Cool. And no more giving away secrets about the podcast. We definitely thought it was live. So yeah, moving on to tracking updates then. Awin's recently released information, you know, relating to its optimization plugin. So what is the plugin and how does it affect Awin's tracking methods?
Yeah, so the tracking optimization plugin, I suppose this is kind of a big release of the year. It's kind of some brand new technology that we've put in within our publisher master tag. I think what separates it a lot is that, you know, it's now publisher led. It's not the advertiser integrating tracking. This is something that the publisher can do to really take control over how they can link towards an advertiser. So the tracking optimization plugin, it sits within the publisher master tag, as I said. You can turn it on with a click of a button. And what that will do, when a user comes and visits your site and clicks on one of your links, based on the environment that user's in, so you know the browser that they're in, the version of that browser, perhaps any settings that they've got activated, the plugin will decide what the best tracking method is. So that way we can guarantee for the publishers, you know, we're going to use the most accurate tracking method possible, because I think in this day and age, we've moved on from the time where, you know, one tracking solution would work for all browsers. The browsers have started to fragment and go off in their own directions around privacy and this sort of thing. So we can't have this single solution. It's having the plugin, which can have a variety of options and really kind of give this sort of a multi-solution solution, if you will.
Yeah, so, you know, not missing out on any sales. I suppose for publishers then, you know, the kind of incentive for them is really to put it on just so the fact that, you know, you're kind of mitigating against those tracking issues that are currently out in the marketplace at the moment that everyone is suffering from.
Exactly. There are some conditions around this and perhaps some ways that it, I suppose, interacts with existing tracking. So, for example, if you're a ConvertLink user, you may not be using Awin tracking links at all. You're just putting in that link direct to the advertiser's site, and ConvertLink is changing that into a tracked link. At the moment, Bouncer's tracking and even the tracking optimization plugin ConvertLink won't work together. The tracking optimization plugin works with Awin tracking links, and as those are clicked, it will do its magic and find that best tracking method. Next year, those two will be combined. That's on the roadmap. But for now, it's kind of one or the other.
So yeah, you mentioned bounceless tracking there. So what is it? It's a new form of tracking offered within the plugin. What is it exactly?
So bounceless tracking is one of the methods that the tracking optimization plugin can use. What makes it different from traditional tracking, and I think why we're so excited about it, is that it's removing the ad network that's typically sitting in between the, you know, the publisher site and the advertiser site when you click on a traditional affiliate link. So rather than have that ad network there, we're directing the user directly from the publisher site to the advertiser site with nothing in between. And I can hear you asking now about how the tracking works, Craig, and I'll tell you. Because it's all powered through the publisher master tag and the tracking optimization plugin, we can make kind of an asynchronous call through the publisher master tag, which kind of does the tracking coming to our servers. And that is then, I suppose, married off through the advertiser master tag when the user arrives on that site. Now, that also does lead to one of the caveats around bouncers tracking within the plugin. It does require the advertiser to have the advertiser master tag integrated.
Cool. Okay. Well, if bouncers is more robust and a more robust form of tracking, why are we not setting it as a default mode of tracking?
A very good question. I think ultimately it's probably a place where we would like to get to, but technically, as how Bouncer's tracking is working, it's using the Beacon API, which only exists in sort of modern browsers. So if a user is using Internet Explorer 8, for example, or an older version of Firefox or Chrome, then we won't be able to use the Beacon API, and therefore Bouncer's tracking won't work. So the plugin will say, okay, well, Bouncer's tracking can't be used. I will use the next best method based on the situation and the environment that we're in of that user. So we, in all cases, we'd like to use it as much as we can. You know, it is the preferred tracking option through the plugin. But of course, again, if the advertiser doesn't have the master tag, it can't do that. And the plugin is quick enough to on-click. It can query and find out, okay, what is the integration state of this advertiser? What tracking method do I need to use? And therefore, it will go ahead. So, I mean, maybe in the future when, I suppose, if the Beacon API becomes standard and given that perhaps other things don't change around tracking in the future, then, you know, it would become a standard.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of self-evolving really, isn't it, when it comes to browsers and versions. So, yeah.
Exactly. And I think it really just kind of emphasizes the point that, you know, one solution doesn't work for everything anymore. And exactly, we have new technologies and new browsers, which not everyone is using. So let's really sort of take advantage of those while we can. And for people who are on old technology, then yeah, there are plenty of other valid methods that still work. The good thing is that these newer browsers that have this technology that we can use, they're also the versions that are being clamped down on with things like, I suppose, ITP or some of the changes that are coming in Chrome or throughout Firefox and that sort of thing. So it actually works quite well in our favor.
Mm. We'll bring back Netscape Navigator, I say.
One day. I'm working on it.
Yeah, so moving on to Google and Chrome in particular. What can you tell us about Awin's response recently then to Google's announcement to upgrade all links in Chrome to HTTPS?
Yes, so they'd announced this a while back that they will start blocking, I suppose, links or sub-resources that are non-secured links on secured sites, and, you know, really moving forward to a place where it's kind of a full HTTPS environment. The good news from an Awin point of view is we've got you covered. For a long time, the links that we've been outputting have been HTTPS links, for example, our tracking links and this sort of thing. I mean, granted, if you were to download a data feed and view that full set of data, there are some HTTP links in there, but these are generally supplied to us by the advertiser. They're not the links that we create in-house and use for tracking. So the important links, everything is HTTPS. I think on top of this, we have a contract has just been signed for a brand new partner in the master tag. I mean, it's somewhat of an exclusive announcement I'm giving you guys here. So Trackonomics will be launching, should be at the beginning of January. I mean, they've got a great solution that's coming out free for publishers. I'm not going to give the game away on exactly what it is. We'll save that for another podcast so I can get my match ball. But one thing that this solution from Trackonomics will do, we'll be able to highlight, you know, where HTTP links are. So within your site, so be able to perform a scan and say, actually, here, you've got a selection of them here that you can therefore go ahead and update and help with this problem. I think it's worth stressing that, you know, the help that we can give and obviously the links we provide are in the affiliate space. And I'm sure publishers, you know, have other things going on their site beside links from Awin. So I really would recommend, you know, to read the Chromium blog and Google recommend some tools that you can use to really kind of help change these links and make sure that your site is compliant. Because come February, you may start seeing like blocks and things like that and bad like warning signs on your website when they sort of put this change in.
Again, it's a self-evolving thing, isn't it? It will eventually just, you know, kind of flitter away in that
indeed,
sense.
Indeed. Yeah. As is the nature of life.
Exactly. Excellent. Well, thanks for the exclusive as well. I mean, that's what we're after here.
That's what you get with product marketing when they come onto the podcast. Yeah. So
excellent.
Happy to be of service.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Ed Chapu there for running us past the latest product updates from Awin, and also to James Maley from Revlifter to talk to us about their proposition and how that's helping retailers personalize discounting to their users. Just some updates relating to content that's coming out over the next couple of weeks. Obviously, in the run-up into Black Friday and the wider Golden Quarter, we've got a series of different content pieces coming out. So do keep your eyes peeled out for those. We've got a series of Black Friday interviews with a wide variety of advertisers, publishers, and agencies talking about their preparations and planning for the big day itself. And on the day itself, we'll be having live reporting, as we always do every year. And you can check that out on our Black Friday Hub, where we'll be discussing live trends and insights relating to activity on the day itself. We'll also have a roundup of Black Friday. And then towards the end of the year, we'll have our peak review and end of year white paper. That's all we've got time for in this month's episode. But I know, Kev, you wanted to quickly just reference the affiliate drinks that are happening very soon.
If you're in London on the 21st of November, there are going to be some very informal networking drinks. We've got a few grand behind the bar donated by various companies, including Awin. And so if you want to come along and just have a few drinks and chat to people in the industry, then go on to Eventbrite and search for affiliate networking drinks, and you should find them. They're up in Shoreditch from about 5 p.m. on Thursday, the 21st of November.
Great. Well, we'll be back in a few weeks' time with another edition of Awin Talks, the very last one of 2019. And that'll be a chance for Craig to defend his title as the affiliate industry quiz champion, which the inaugural edition he won controversially last year.
I just know more about affiliates than Kevin Edwards.
I mean, that's a controversial statement in itself, but we'll bypass that.
Okay, fine.
But as always, if you wanted to reach out and contact us, you can do so on our dedicated podcast email address, which is awintalks@awin.com. But for now, it's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Craig.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from Kev.
Bye.